Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, April 12th, 2019 edition of the News Gazette. And we'll begin on the front page with a piece about the Illinois Power Agency Lottery called Maybe Next Year for Urbana Solar Project by Adalberto Toledo, Urbana. When it comes to lotteries, there are always winners and losers. Wednesday's Illinois Power Agency Lottery was no exception. Only five area community solar projects won renewable energy credits from the Future Energy Jobs Act among over 1,000 applicants in the state. The project to bring a solar array to Urbana's old landfill site was not one of them, much to the disappointment of the City of Urbana's Environmental Sustainability Manager, Scott Tess. We certainly knew the interest far exceeded the capacity or the lottery Wednesday, Les Tess said. We knew we had a statistically low chance, but were optimistic looking forward at other incentives. Back in December, Urbana City Council members voted to strike a lease option agreement with San Jose, California-based SunPower DevCo, which allowed them to apply to the incentives lottery. The two-year lease option agreement, the first of three steps to realizing the solar energy project, would give SunPower the exclusive right to develop solar arrays on 41 acres of Urbana's landfill property, managed by the Champaign-Urbana Solid Waste Disposal System. Under the agreement, SunPower would have the exclusive right for 2 years to develop the property, as well as a lease renewal option in the event it can't secure incentives or funding in that time. But in order for them to start work on the array, they have to be secure in knowing who they'll sell the energy to. Without the incentives, Tess said, it's not likely that the energy output generated by the array would be cheap enough to stave off competition from natural gas and other popular sources. The immediate next step for SunPower will be to apply for next year's incentives lottery. These incentives are probably the best available, Tess said. There are other projects that can sell their solar renewable energy credits, but these are really the best incentives out there. The goal is ultimately to develop the capital necessary to allow us to bring down the price of solar energy close to or at market value. It's all about securing off-takers or buyers for that electricity. There's still a lot to be optimistic about when it comes to bringing solar to Urbana. Tess said his department is currently working on the rollout of Solar Urbana's fourth year. This year, the city has competitively selected a single vendor through Midwest Renewable Energy Association to bolster the purchasing program for small homes and businesses in town. There's also solar power hours, which Tess hopes will further educate the public about solar energy through one-hour events, focusing on its possible local impacts. You'll learn everything you need to know about solar and bulk purchasing opportunities, Tess said. Mayor Diane Marlin said she hopes SunPower will be selected during the next lottery. I think locating a solar project on the closed landfill makes sense from a land use perspective, she said. It saves farmland from being taken out of production. And the next piece is from Krannert Center called There at the Beginning. Grand opening performer is returning for 50th anniversary by Anthony Zillis. His upcoming performance was to be a huge one, but in the days leading up to the Krannert Center's grand opening in 1969, Shozo Sato stopped his kabuki theater rehearsal in its tracks on the Colwell Playhouse floor when a few special visitors entered the room. After all, without a $16 million gift from Herman and Elnora Krannert, who walked in with what Sato called their entourage, the stage he was standing on wouldn't have existed. I stopped the rehearsal and thanked them for the great gift, and they were very, very happy that not a typical American, but a Japanese, and in those days totally unique, performance would take place at the grand opening, Sato said. Within that short period of time, I have a wonderful memory of actually seeing them, actually thanking them, and they were very, very gracious. At Saturday's 50th anniversary gala for Krannert Center, Sato thinks he'll be the only person in attendance who actually met the Krannerts. He's one of the few who will remember the coin laundries, small restaurants, and stores that lined the area where the behemoth of Krannert Center for the Performing Arts now lies. He's not the only one still around who was at the opening festival and enjoyed the revelation that was Krannert Center in the early years, though. Al Huang was also there. Huang, who is performing several times as part of Krannert's multi-year 50th anniversary celebration, but has to miss Saturday's gala because of a scheduling conflict, showed up to the long-ago formal event in his Nehru jacket and platform shoes. "It was quite spectacular," Huang said. "The whole town turned out in their gowns and pearls and diamonds in the lobby. At that time, it was the Lincoln Center in the middle of the country." While it was a spectacle in its time, Krannert's opening wasn't without its hiccups. "Those planning the allocation of space," Sato said, "didn't consider the amount of storage they needed so steadily. Storage space took over rooms meant for other functions. Some of the concrete in the building didn't set because of a rush to finish it," he said. "So the parking garage struggled for years with issues. But in most ways, it was a forward-thinking masterpiece. It's remarkable having one of the three major performing arts centers in the middle of a cornfield," Sato said. "That's remarkable. And the remarkable foresight of Mr. and Mrs. Krannert, knowing that the University of Illinois in the 60s, we didn't have any stage or any theater to speak of, and therefore the dean said, 'If you're going to do donations, we would love to have a performing arts center.' They agreed, and then they gave that much money." Krannert was immediately renowned across the country. Donald Hanahan of the New York Times called it one of the most ingeniously worked-out art complexes anywhere, shortly after it opened. And Thomas Willis off the Chicago Tribune said it was equaled by few such facilities in the country. 50 years later, Sato and Huang know it's easy for Krannert to fade into the background and for some residents to take it for granted. But they remember a time when there wasn't a suitable stage for professional artists like them and for symphonies and operas to stand on. And after 5 decades, it still holds up. "It should be the pride of the University of Illinois and on the Champaign-Urbana campus," Huang said. "I certainly feel very proud to live in this town, not only to occasionally contribute, but also to partake as an audience member, to go to great, great events." And we'll turn now to the 21st Roger Ebert's Film Festival and begin with a piece about the film Rachel Getting Married, emotional 2008 film Emotional Audience by Frank R. Piper, Champaign. It was an emotional day, too, at Roger Ebert's Film Festival. Not in a bad way, of course, but emotional in the way that families can be when they come together and embrace each other, while at the same time share a tear or two, as well as a smile for those loved ones no longer with them. It can choke a person up, which was the reaction of more than one festival guest after Thursday afternoon's showing of director Jonathan Demme's 2008 film, Rachel Getting Married. From host Chaz Ebert to filmmakers and special guests Michael Barker and Stephen Apkin. Part of the film's emotional impact, of course, is because it is one of the last films made by Demme before his death in April 2017, and as both Barker and Apkin pointed out, it was one of his most personal, cast with family and friends, from Demme's son, Brooklyn, playing guitar in the opening scene, to the director's black poodle, Olive, seeking out a little affection from the title bride in the final shot. But even more impactful to Thursday's audience was the film's focus on extended family, coming together to celebrate life even while struggling to come to grips with grief and heartache. The theme of Ebertfest as a family event was shared by Chaz Ebert, who told the Virginia Theater audience before the film that while hearing herself quoted in the newspaper occasionally takes her aback, because I'm just an in-the-moment kind of person and not always thinking about how she sounds, I think of you as my family, so if I fall, you're going to be there to catch me. You're my safety net. Barker, who as co-president and co-founder of Sony Pictures Classics released Rachel Getting Married, added another perspective to the parallels between the family wedding in the film and Ebertfest, now in its 21st year. Noting the number of festival favorites who have passed away in recent years, the actor Scott Wilson, to whom this year's festival is dedicated, to Roger Ebert himself, Barker pointed out that the festival also offers a therapeutic benefit to those who attend year after year. "What is amazing about this festival," Barker said in introducing his late friend's movie, "is we're dealing with grief as a celebration for these people that have passed away. And I think there is no other event like it. And I will come here as long as you invite me. There's just no question." The extended family theme got a significant boost during the Q&A session of the film, when the film's screenwriter, Jenny Lumet, joined the conversation via telephone. Barker introduced her as the daughter of director Sidney Lumet and granddaughter of singer-actress Lena Horne, and Lumet laughingly added her own children to the mix, saying she wanted them to hear what was being said about her because they think I'm really uncool. And the next piece about Ebertfest is about the movie Cœur Fidèle, called Silent Classic, Quite an Eyeful for the Time, by Paul Wood, Champagne. Thursday's silent film offering showed Ebertfest filmgoers the then-modern techniques and dizzying shots of a century ago. Jean Epstein's Cœur Fidèle, The Faithful Heart in French, was 2019's entry in the festival's silent film tradition. Another tradition the audience enjoyed, accompaniment by the Alloy Orchestra. Guests had to wait a few minutes for the film to commence. At first, a conventional but pretty score accompanied the film, but as soon as it faded, an accordion began to play, and the Alloy Orchestra took over with a vengeance. Music has already been a hit at this year's Roger Ebert's Film Festival, as Chaz Ebert said she was pleasantly surprised with the reaction to the festival opener, the Aretha Franklin concert film Amazing Grace. She was concerned people would not be excited by a church music documentary. "The reaction was universally wonderful," she said. On Cœur Fidèle, Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips noted that relatively few moviegoers had seen the 1923 film, which was lauded by French critics in the years after its release. Epstein was avant-garde by 1923 standards, the critics said, with wildly moving camera scenes in Cœur Fidèle, quite an eyeful for the time. Phillips, who co-hosted 100 episodes of the Ebert-founded At the Movies TV show, said Epstein was born in Poland, went to the University of Lyon to study medicine, and went to work for the pioneering Lumiere filmmakers. He noted Epstein's use of the close-up. The film opens with a tight shot of the overworked and underappreciated Marie in a Marseille bar. "Cinema is true. A story is a lie," Epstein once said, among other pronouncements. "He could be kind of a petulant guy," Phillips said. And also from Ebertfest, what did they say? News Gazette Media's Frank Pieper breaks down Fest's major moments. "My favorite Fest moments, day two. My favorite Ebert-Fest exchange so far involving actresses Jennifer Tilly and Gina Gershon took place at Thursday morning's Women in Cinema panel discussion at the Hyatt Place Hotel in downtown Champaign. Moderator Chaz Ebert recalled for Gershon that Roger Ebert considered her one of his favorite people to interview and was impressed with how smart she was. He said that you had a level of intelligence that's not often found in Hollywood. Tilly, seated next to Gershon, piped up, "Well, what did he say about me?" Amid the burst of audience laughter, Chaz floundered a moment for a response. "He loved you. He loved you, Jennifer," before recovering to add, "I'll tell you exactly what he said about you. He said you have to be smart as a fox to play someone dumb." And Jennifer Marin, film journalist, critic, and president of the Alliance of Women Film Journalists, provided some of the keenest insights at the aforementioned panel discussion and drew one of the biggest ovations when she concluded her remarks on how the statistics about women's underrepresentation in the film industry ought not to be the focus. It's not that women are not producing films. It's that the films that they make are not being recognized, they're not being respected, they're not being made available to audiences who are interested in them, and that is something that we really need to change. We can't keep looking at, we want a bigger piece of that pie. We have to change the ingredients of the pie. We want a different pie. As audience members, we have to demand this, and as critics, we have to pay attention to the films that are being ignored. Sony Pictures co-founder Michael Barker blamed his late arrival to his scheduled panel seat on his iPhone, which he said had failed to adjust for the time change since he flew in from New York the day before. But he quickly made up for lost time with a few astute observations of his own, including on how Ebertfest serves a function in grieving old friends who have recently passed away, like actor Scott Wilson, who died last October, and director Agnes Varda, who died March 29th. "Sometimes I think the real value of Ebertfest are the people we miss," he said. "It's almost like the grieving for the people we're really close to never ends, but the way we can do it here is to celebrate them." And now we'll turn to the opinions page and begin with an editorial called "Fair Warning. Taxpayers, it's that time of year again." Monday, April 15th, is the deadline for taxpayers to file their annual returns with the Internal Revenue Service. That's why the U.S. Attorney for Central Illinois issued a news release this week that is about as subtle as a sledgehammer blow to the head. U.S. Attorney John Millhiser, in effect, urged taxpayers to pay up or face the ugly consequences that go along with income tax evasion. "To protect the integrity of our nation's tax system, we work year-round to investigate and prosecute individuals who violate our laws. It is our responsibility to hold accountable those who attempt to cheat the system for personal gain." There's no reason to doubt Millhiser's claim that he and his Eager Beaver team of prosecutors positively drool in excitement over the prospect of throwing tax evaders in the slammer for a couple of years. But just in case the targets of his message were not persuaded, Millhiser provided several examples of what has happened to those who try to cheat the system. There was the owner of a Springfield restaurant who removed funds from the restaurant's business account to make investments and then failed to disclose that investment income to his accountant. He faces up to 5 years in prison when sentenced August 2nd for filing false tax returns. Another taxpayer who ran afoul of tax laws is a former Springfield business owner who failed to report more than $1.15 million in earnings for the 2008, 9, and 10 tax years. The businessman was sentenced last June to 18 months in prison and was required to pay the IRS $447,528 and another $250,000 to participants in his company's employee stock ownership plan. Also falling victim to the Fed's aggressive tax prosecution policy was the Henry County paving contractor, who received 4 years in prison for tax evasion. He also was ordered to pay $566,671 in back taxes and interest to the IRS. There's more, but readers get the idea. The IRS wants the money it's owed and has ways of locating and prosecuting those who run afoul of the law. Millhiser warned that those who might consider preparing false and fraudulent tax returns should be aware of the extremely negative consequences that could result in prison time and large tax bills, including substantial fines, interest, and penalties. And the next editorial is called One Rule for All. Legislators need to realize that school districts have only so much money. Legislators in the Illinois House and Senate this week passed several and different versions of legislation that sets a minimum annual teacher salary of $40,000 by the 2023-24 school year. That minimum salary is, at least theoretically, not excessive. But legislators disserve the public when they intervene in market issues with their one-size-fits-all 102 counties in Illinois approach. If and when members of the House and Senate iron out their differences and send the bill to Governor J.B. Pritzker, he will almost certainly sign it. The politically powerful teachers' unions supported Pritzker's gubernatorial campaign last year, so he is almost certain to reimburse them for their support. The Senate's bill establishes a minimum $32,076 annual salary for teachers in Illinois that rises to $40,000. It is similar to legislation vetoed last year by GOP Governor Bruce Rauner. Paying a $40,000 minimum wage will be no problem for school districts in Chicago and the suburbs, but circumstances could be altogether difficult in less affluent and politically influential districts downstate. The legislation was promoted as a means of addressing the shortage of teachers. If so, it's an unnecessary effort that ignores the law of supply and demand. Greater market demand and competition for teachers will encourage salary increases. But allowing the free market to operate would provide the flexibility some school districts require in fashioning their responses to budgetary issues. School districts have only so much money. When forced by the legislature to spend it one way, they have no choice but to reduce expenditures in other ways that also will have an impact on the education they offer. But too bad for them. The legislature is speaking with its usual ham-handed blunderbuss style. And we'll look now at the From Our Readers section and begin with a piece written by Jamie Lee of Champaign called U.S. Healthcare System Needs Fixes. The U.S. has one of the most unjust, inefficient, and expensive healthcare systems in the world. We waste billions of dollars on profit-driven insurance companies, overpriced programs, and services, drugs, and medical equipment. Therefore, I do not think we have a uniform health care system and proper health care coverage for everyone, especially the underserved populations. I am doing a project with the vision to provide affordable and high-quality health care for everyone in America. The first objective is to consolidate services for better quality and lower costs. Payment methods, such as for prescription drugs, need to be based on value, effectivity, and evidence-based approaches that provide an outcome of great client satisfaction. Also, insurance should be available to anyone when people need it, and with benefits created to keep care accessible and affordable. We need to focus less on acute care hospitals as the center of our health care system and plan to execute more fully integrated clinical networks of care, from prevention and wellness to end-of-life care. The healthcare system should present the idea that the most potent strategy to reduce healthcare costs is to keep clients healthy and protected from severe conditions. Reforming, fortifying, and modernizing our health delivery system to improve the quality and value of care is important to address the rising costs, poor quality, and expanding numbers of people without health insurance coverage and other service or program benefits. It is crucial that we achieve better care across a complex healthcare system. And that again was written by Jamie Lee of Champaign. The next piece is written by Linda Locke of Tuscola, called Chief Eagle Would Go Well Together. Recently, someone wrote that the University of Illinois mascot should be an eagle. I agree, but I also think that Chief Illiniwek should be involved. The Native Americans respect and revere the bald eagle. Google Native Americans and eagles. The eagle is a huge part of Indian culture and tradition, which include an eagle dance. Chief Illiniwek is also respected and revered in Illinois with a tradition dating back many, many years. What a powerful message to have Chief Illiniwek here to honor the Illini Nation, the eagle here to honor the United States of America, and both here to honor the UI. Wow! And that again was written by Linda Locke of Tuscola. And the last one's written by David Eisenman of Champaign, called Maybe the IRS Isn't to Blame. I have argued previously that IRS delays in completing audits of our beloved leaders' taxes are a disgrace. They have unfairly prevented this man of unquestioned integrity from keeping his promise to release his taxes once the audits are complete. I have called before the congressional action a targeted IRS appropriation to complete these audits. But after 2 more years of delay, I see that I may have misunderstood. Perhaps the president's own team is causing the delays. Perhaps they don't want to share the ingenious ways in which he and his team have exploited tax laws, written, of course, by people far less intelligent and creative than they are. In video from his campaign, available readily online, he states that he minimizes his tax payments on principle because he has not approved of such government waste as the trillion-dollar Bush wars fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now that he is president, has he concluded that his sharing his tax tricks with us would be bad? Because with him in charge, the government now actually does a few things worth paying for? Such as the defense expenditures his budget seeks, which come to more than $2,000 a year per American? Has he arrived at the astonishing realization that only his genius could see? Someone needs actually to pay taxes? Not his sort, of course, as his fellow New York real estate mogul Leona Helmsley explained. Taxes are paid only by the little people, like us. Was I wrong to blame the IRS for these delays? If so, my apologies. And that again was written by David Eisenman of Champaign. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, April 12th, 2019 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.